session number 3994, Rule 2.
Frontier post, were there any other signs of Italian activity?
Practically never. One occasionally heard stories of Italian troops or Ethiopian Italian troops moving in the area, and further north, I was pretty well bang in the middle of the line of frontier. Later on, when I joined C Company, the Mounted Company, and was much nearer French Somaliland to the northwest, there was much more Italian activity there, and in fact one used to occasionally make contact with them. On one occasion, I remember, I heard a rumor, which later became a confirmed story, that from Somalis, that there was a body of Ethiopians. And by this time, the Ethiopian war was pretty well over. The Italians were merely tidying up. I heard a story that there was a large body of about 400 Ethiopians, men, women and children, with sheep and goats and cattle, moving steadily across the Ogaden to seek sanctuary in British Somaliland. Well, when they got very near, I could hear the sounds of them being shelled and bombed from the air, and I went over to the Italian post at a place called Gokte. And there they were bringing medium guns into action, and they had a command post there, and I was shown all the dispositions on the operations map, and they described to me what they were going to do and how they were going to do it, and that the Ethiopians hadn't a chance of escaping. And so, having gathered what information I could, I then went back, rode back to my own hutch, and the next morning, very early, I rode down to the troop to the frontier, only about 2 miles down to the frontier, to see what was happening. I see a lot of people moving. The bush was alive with people. It was a fairly open country, and I could only see them at long range. And I got in touch with an old Somali woman, and I said, what's happening? And she said, well, everybody's dead. They're all killed. So I felt, well, that's bad luck all that way, and be killed in the last with safety within reach. And I said, what, all the Ethiopians? She screamed with laughter and cackled out, no, all the Italians. And in fact, the Ethiopians they'd suffered some casualties, but nothing very, very serious, and there were about 400 of them who turned up as refugees, and we had to look after them and guard them and see to them.
What had in fact happened on that occasion when all the Italians were killed?
Well, they'd Ethiopians, who were quite well armed, had just fought a pitched battle and killed them. And there were not a lot of Italian troops in the air, I don't think, but certainly in a comparable situation, a British force would not have had any trouble in seeing who was to win. But the Ethiopians were a remarkable bunch. There were everything from one chap who'd been educated at Saint-Cyr, the French Sandhurst, to completely untutored savages who were living 5 centuries back. But one thing was for sure, that they were determined to get to seek safety, and they got it. And it was rather an interesting experience. I mean, some of their weapons would have been museum pieces. Some of them were. They had a couple of machine guns which they pinched from the Italians. They were quite well armed, and they just fought their way through.
How long did you stay down at your first frontier post?
Oh, about three or four months.
What was the setup there?
Well, there was myself and one troop, about 30 Somalis, sergeant, a few corporals, and the rest private soldiers. We lived in tents, we made no attempt to wire ourselves in or establish a defensive position. There were slit trenches for local alarm, but otherwise no defensive measures taken. The supplies arrived by hired civilian trade truck, and your water supply was quite an interesting one, because your water supply was about 90 miles away, and your only link, you had one civilian trade truck permanently with you, that was all. And you sent off, when you were short of water, you sent off the trade truck with four or five or six 44-gallon drums and a fatigue party, and they set off for the water, and then you relied on them coming back. Well, in a country where of no roads and old, battered old trade trucks, it was remarkable that one never actually ran short of anything. Because if a truck had broken down, either at the water or halfway there or halfway back, some days would have lapsed before anybody knew about it at all. So you were very dependent on this rather tenuous link of the local trade truck. But it worked. And a lot of your day was taken up, certainly the soldier's day was taken up with merely keeping alive in cooking and eating and watering and maintenance, keeping the camp clean, and a little bit of rudimentary training, weapon training, little tactical training. But by the time everybody had done their stuff, there was not an awful lot of spare time.
How did you react to being given so much responsibility so soon after arriving in Somalia?
I was delighted. I'd feared that I'd be kept in the headquarters station for, say, 3 or 4 months, I thought, to learn the language and learn the ropes and so on. And instead of that, I was a matter of 2 days I was on my way. And I should mention that you had Somali interpreters. The Somali itself is a very difficult language, very, very difficult language, and you either had a year for it or you didn't. But every British officer had his own interpreter, and they were a remarkable band. They were more like, as you can imagine, they were much more educated. Some of them had spoke with a strong American accent, and they'd all been round the world much more, been out in the world more. They were, you had to rely on them, because you could not, certainly when in your early days, you couldn't possibly tell whether you were being faithfully translated or not. So therefore he was in a position of great influence. If a man was trying to explain his case to you, you were entirely dependent on the interpreter. If he cared to put an adverse face on it, how would you know? They were very important chaps, and to my knowledge, they never let the side down. They were always. I never knew of any trouble or any serious complaints by soldiers that they'd been mistranslated, or that one had been mistranslated to them, which is quite a high testimonial for them. They were very much one's right-hand man. And, I mean, on parade or on patrol, your interpreter rode literally at your right hand. Not on a formal drill parade where you didn't need an interpreter because all commands were given in English. But you had your interpreter in your pocket. He was a terribly important chap. And they, as I said, I never knew them. I never knew of a case where they let the side down and caused, they could so easily, for private purposes, have caused tremendous amount of discontent.
Can you remember any individual interpreters?
Well, I naturally remember very clearly my own, who was with me really from my very early days until the evacuation, a fellow called Haji Derya Mahmoud. And Haji Derya, he was then Derya Haji, indicating he wished to go on the pilgrimage to Mecca, thereby earn the title of Haji. And in due course, he did, in fact, make the pilgrimage and became Haji Derya Mahmoud. He was a most remarkable man. He could deal accurately with virtually any subject, from scale of pay or the intricacies of a weapon or what you were trying to put over tactically in the intention and the method by which you'd operate. He was an absolute tower of strength. Very, very remarkable man. Absolutely, in my opinion, absolutely trustworthy. I have a very, very high regard for him to this day.
Did the interpreters have military rank?
No, and they could wear what they liked. In fact, they mostly, more or less, conformed. Khaki trousers and khaki shirt and a khaki turban or pagri. And so they were, and on ceremonial occasions, such as a pretty rare visit by some more senior officer, then they would turn themselves out in a bush shirt and really make an effort, but they had no particular uniform. Their position was very difficult to define, really. But if you got a good one, as I did, one leant heavily on him, and I never had any backlash or any suggestion that his performance had been anything but of the very highest order.
Do you know where they'd been educated?
A lot of them had had been educated in Aden. Some had been to the school in the Sudan, in Khartoum, and a lot of them had picked it up at sea. They're great seamen, and in their travels around the world, and a lot of them spoke with a slight American accent, or very pronounced. There was one who had a very, very pronounced Bronx accent, and this question of education is one I might touch on because it has great bearing on at least it has its comic aspects. In 1937, in Brau, I was sitting doing my scanty office work one morning at about 11 o'clock when I heard bang, 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 sound of firing from the native town. And at the same time, I got the soldiers, who obviously knew something was going to happen, had kept the standby troop of ponies close at hand, and they were all the best, fastest, and hottest ponies in the whole push. They had them saddled in no time at all. I then got a message from the commanding officer to take a troop and go over to see what was happening. I rode over and into the town, found in the middle of the town the district commissioner and a chap who was introducing a slight measure of education. He called himself director of education, I think, and six or eight policemen, and surrounded by a number of dead bodies. And this riot, which had then halted, there was nothing happening very much, it was a sort of stalemate. And I asked the district commissioner what was happening. He said, well, they're protesting against this education. Well, I should mention that the degree of education, Somali is an unwritten language, or was then. It is now a written language, but I don't know how successful it is. It was then an unwritten language, and all transactions were in, usually Arabic. And it was felt by the government that a tiny measure of education to train a number of small boys, volunteers and their parents wishing them to do it, to receive sufficient education in Arabic, to be able to read and write Arabic, and keep accounts. A fairly limited, modest measure of education. And there were about 8 or 10 small, I should think 7 or 8 year olds, selected for this. And this was the first day of term. And of course, the Somali priests, the Somali mullahs, were the only people who could read the Quran, the Islamic Bible, and they realized that if everybody could read Arabic, they would be able to read the Quran for themselves and realize that it was not written that on the second month of the full moon, second week of the full moon, that it is lawful, it is written that every man shall contribute 1/10 of his income to the mullah. And so they determined to stop this and whipped up enthusiasm, resentment to fever pitch, which is not difficult with the Somali. It's one of his handicaps. He's very excitable, very quick, very quick-tempered. And they whipped up this riot, which cost something like a dozen lives, and thinking, well, that'll stop this education nonsense. Well, to a certain extent, it did. The government didn't dare tiptoe into that particular arena again. 10 years later, in 1947, when I was in Hargeisa, I heard the familiar pop, pop, bang, bang in the native town, and this was a riot involving, again, quite a little bit of loss of life, quite a lot of firing, and that riot was because the government was not doing enough in education.
But I believe that later on you had some feedback, as it were, from the first riot.
Yes, I went to, I was asked if I'd go out to represent the War Office at the ceremony of independence in 1960, and I was Colonel Commandant by then, which, as you know, is an honorary appointment. If I would go out to represent the War Office at the ceremony of independence, and at one of the functions, one of the new Somali ministers who I was chatting to said that he was, we got onto the subject of education somehow, and he said, well, of course, I, years and years ago, I was, I attended that little beginning of a school in Barra, and I always remember the riot, and I always remember a British officer shepherding us away to the to the district commissioner's office, to shepherding us away to safety. And of course, it was me. I should more grammatically say it was I.
What happened after your posting down at this small frontier station?
Well, then I went, as I say, after 3 or 4 months, I joined the C Company, the Mounted Company, and then we were in a very, very nicely placed, the north, the western end of the country, which is the nicest of the lot. Trees, water, grass, mountains, very, very nice country indeed. And we spent some months there. Then we moved to Hargeisa, which was one of the permanent stations where there were actual mud hut barracks. And each officer had his own bungalow, a garden, 2 polo fields, and a district commissioner and a doctor. So there was quite a little sort of tiny, mini community there. And that was very pleasant. There were three, actually, at that time. There was we had a, I don't know why, we had a glut of officers. We had a company commander, a new company commander, who had succeeded Campbell Miles, who'd gone home, who was a highly wonderful commander. He knew Somalis backwards, and he was a great commander. The new commander, I won't mention his name, was a very, very cantankerous, difficult character. He was only a subaltern, but he was a difficult character with a capacity for provoking resistance and hostility, which he used to the full. And in fact, he did, cut a long story short, he provoked what, mutiny is far too strong a word, but a disturbance at about 11 o'clock at night. The barrack square became filled with excited Somalis waving their sticks in the air and shouting and yelling. And they, as a result, a certain amount of reshuffle went on, and the company commander was included in the reshuffle. He was dispatched home. Before that, you know, the three of us, subaltern and another chap called Ernie Vaux of the Queen's Bays, who sat a horse better than anybody I've ever seen. He was brilliant on a horse, and very good polo player, and he had a very bad fall playing polo, and lingered on in Langley's bungalow. The other subaltern and I took turns at nursing him, because there was no nursing facilities or anything, and he died in Aden. Actually, they couldn't do anything for him there, so took him back to Aden by air, and he died. So that left the other subaltern was sent home. He was dead. The other subaltern went home. And then I was, on the departure of that other subaltern, I was given command of the company. And we then moved to a place called Sikh, which is was near another place called Sheikh, which is on the main Barra-Berbera road, right up in the mountains. Lovely climate, lovely place, lots of water, running water. And there we spent some months, and then moved to Barra. And Barra was featured in my life quite a lot for the rest of my service with the Camel Corps, where I stayed on with C Company. And we, apart from fairly long excursions to the east, down to the Nogal Valley, which was getting down towards the Italian frontier, which that took some weeks and months, not just a quick trip there and back. That took quite a long time. That from Bra, one did a lot of moving out and moving in, and I was in fact in Bra when war was declared.
How long were you at Hargeisa?
About 6 or 8 months. Very nice place it was too. It was marvellous partridge shooting, and lions, leopard, kudu, and as I said, two peregrines.
What was the setup there?
Well, roughly it was, on the civil side you had a district commissioner and a doctor, and at times you had an assistant district commissioner, but that was a rarity. It was usually on his own. And I don't think there was any other civilian at that time. The doctor was there. The doctor was single-handed. He'd never had any nurses or assistants. There were a number of trained Somali dressers who were quite good. I always remember with affection one dresser I had who was an enormous man. He was almost the size of, very unlike a Somali, he was a colossal chap. He was more like General Idi Amin in size, a very much nicer character. And I received a report that one evening that there'd been an accident. An enormous load of hay had fallen on three soldiers. Hay for the ponies had fallen on three soldiers, and they were badly injured. So I went to the scene of the accident and found three soldiers lying on the ground shouting, "Allah, Allah, Allah." And when I appeared, of course, the shouts became even louder. "Allah, Allah." And, oh, my God, they were in agony. They were ruined for life. And so I sent for the dresser who arrived. He towered over, examined them briefly, just had a quick twitch at them, and leant over them and shouted in a voice of thunder, "Get up!" There was dead silence. They all got up and walked away.
What were your duties at Hargeisa?
Really, most of the time, one made the odd excursion from there. Mostly it was very much Somali garrison duty, really. Normal training. And a normal day would be get up at half past five, quarter to six, on parade, your horse and your orderly's horse really waiting outside, mounted and rode off to parade, inspected parade, training until say 9 o'clock. You couldn't go on very much longer because it was essential to get the ponies adequate grazing, and they had to go quite a long way out. They couldn't graze round the place, it was forbidden, because you destroyed all the grass, all the shrubs and the trees. So they were taken under guard, probably 4, 5, 6 miles away. But they had to get in, and then to graze for the rest of the day and be brought in the evening, which was the Somali way of life of a Somali pony. And so by half past 8 or 9, it was time to dismiss and get the grazing guard and the ponies away to their day's grazing. You had breakfast rather leisurely with probably at times 3 weeks old, propped up against your toast rack, and then back to the little, hardly call it a barracks, but the huts and the square, and there would be either, I mean, if you were preparing for some particular purpose, like whatever it may be, a drill parade or weapon training, or minor tactical training, which went on till about 11, half past 11, then administration and lunch, a siesta, play polo, or it wasn't a polo day, shooting, and then in the evening you had evening stables, which lasted from about 5 till 20 past, half past 6, when the ponies were all, you had all the ponies and all the men grooming, and then when they were all groomed and you inspected them all, they were all then fed at the same instant, which was always rather a charming moment. The ponies knew as well as anybody else that the moment had nearly arrived, and they could just go frantic with excitement. And then, of course, immediately silence dropped. Remember, they got their noses into their nose bags. And then that was back to the mess, and where we probably sat and chatted for a time, had a bath, dinner, chatted and went to bed. Very pleasant life.
What was the military establishment at Hargeisa?
That was one company. Of the chemical organization was a regimental headquarters, which was, by any standard, minute. The commanding officer, the second in command, the adjutant, and the quartermaster. Now, the quartermaster was rather a remarkable chap. He'd been there since... he was an ex-gunner from the ranks, like most quartermasters, and he'd been in Somaliland, quartermaster of the Camel Corps from about 1925, 26, I think. And he was, as you can imagine, he'd lasted that length of time, and everybody had been happy with him and content to keep him on. He was a quite exceptional man, quite exceptional. Wonderful sense of humour, a most tremendously unshakable honesty of thought and purpose and act, and with a very charming wife, and they ran a vegetable garden which supplied everybody for miles around. And he was the most marvellous man to deal with, because unlike a lot of quartermasters, you know, he was never obstructive, he was never stupid, he never ran by the book, he did what common sense demanded. And but if you forgot to do something, you were lent some article of military equipment which you were to return in 9 months' time. When the 9 months was up, he said, "Where is that thing?" And one said, "Sorry, Uncle, I'll get it for you straight away." He was a wonderful, wonderful personality, great chap. Then there was that was CO, second command, adjutant, and quartermaster. That was the British staff. That was the day, in 1936. There was the beginnings of mechanization, and there was one British NCO who was Staff Sergeant Willis. I remember his name now. Who lived a rather peculiar, isolated and monastic life. Not monastic is the wrong word. Rather solitary life. In a little bungalow of his own. He had a devoted dog. And he had his own little establishment, his own boys, servants and cooks and so on. He was very well paid. And his responsibility was to look after the transport and train Somalis to look after in there, and the Yao Company, which I'll come on to in a second. But he was the only British NCO, which was a very wise thing, because Somalis are awful snobs, and they don't take kindly to being bossed about by somebody who they think is inferior to themselves, which in some cases with the British NCO, they'd feel that it was an indignity to be pushed around by Corporal Smith or Lance Corporal Jones. They wouldn't take it. They'd take it if they had to, but they wouldn't be happy about it. And so that was the headquarters. And then there were... there was one camel company, which was mounted entirely on camels, with half a dozen ponies for the company commander and an immediate, rather sort of quicker moving party.